before anybody gives me alcohol.
We're live and sober, and I didn't want to say it last night, but I didn't like the Beatles growing up, you know. I don't know why I had to tell you that. It's a small window. My older brothers, they loved the Beatles. I was more of a Led Zeppelin, Rolling Stones type of guy, but, you know, whatever. So, on awakening, we consider our plans for the day. Oh, by the way, I have a home group. It's called the West Side Boys of Plantation, Florida. That's if I ever move, but I doubt it. But so, on awakening, you know, we consider our plans for the day. And I don't think Bill meant we consider what we have to do today. We all have something to do, right? We all have a list of work, kids, this, that, every other thing. But I think what he's really talking about is we consider our plans of who are we going to be today, right? Who are we going to be today? Based on maybe an inventory that I did the night before, you know, when we retire at night. You know, where did I fall short yesterday? You know, today's Saturday, but where did I fall short yesterday? Who do I want to be today, right? So, prayer becomes a very important part of everything. I'm sure you all know that already. A bunch of years back, I was walking in a retreat house, and I saw this little book, and I picked it up. And it's a book of prayers for retreats. And, you know, there's third step, seventh step. There's a prayer of St. Francis, prayer for forgiveness, prayer for your health, prayer for others, prayer, you know, prayer, 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 prayer. It's all in here. I'm going to leave it up here. If any of you guys want to take a look at it, take pictures of it, go ahead. Or give me your address. I can get these sent to you, too. It really just, especially when I was new, because I didn't know how to pray. You know, I was praying for all my selfish needs. I wanted to hit the lottery. I wanted her. I wanted this. I didn't really know how to ask God to just give me guidance and strength throughout the day. But this one prayer that's in here, the one that opens up the book, it's called the morning prayer. And I like to set the table by saying this prayer. I'll also leave that prayer up here if you guys want to take a picture of it. It's a little bit long, but it really sets the table for who I want to be today, right? Not what I have to do. So God of my life, I welcome this new day. It is your gift to me, the first day of the rest of my life. I thank you for the gift of being alive this morning. I thank you for the sleep which has refreshed me. I thank you for the chance to begin life all over again. Lord, this day is full of promise and of opportunity. Help me to waste none of it. This day is full of mystery of the unknown. Help me to face it without fear or without anxiety. This day is full of beauty and adventure. Help me to be fully alive to it all. During this day, may I become a more thoughtful person, a more prayerful person, a more generous and kindly person. May I not be turned in on myself, but be sensitive and helpful to others. Let me do nothing today that would harm anyone. Rather, let me help at least a little to make life more pleasant for those I meet. When night comes, may I look back on this day without regret. May nobody be unhappy because of anything I have done or anything I have failed to do. Lord, bless this day for me and for all of us. Make it a day in which we grow more in knowing and carrying out your will. Dear God, I spend so much time reliving yesterday or anticipating tomorrow that I lose sight of the only time that is really mine, the present moment. You give me today, one moment at a time. That's all I have, all I'll ever have. Give me the faith to know that each moment contains exactly what is best for me. Give me the hope to trust you enough so that I may forget past failures and future trials. Give me the love to make each moment in anticipation of living forever with you. O Lord, support us all the day long until shadows lengthen and evening comes, until the busy world is hushed and the fever of life is over and our work is done. Then in your mercy, grant us safe lodging and holy rest and peace in your heart. Amen. And it's a little long, but you know, I don't judge how long a prayer is, but it just sets the table for who I want to be today. Let me be a channel to spirit. Let me be a channel to this power called God. Let me hear what you need to say. Can I see the God in you? Can you see the God in me? The fundamental idea of God is in each and every one of us. Can I see that in you as we talk and share it with each other throughout the weekend? So, you know, I'm going to talk about some things today, or this morning anyway, this first session. One of the greatest gifts we have by going to a fellowship, whether it's AA, NACA, whatever A it is, you know, is this idea of identification. You know, one drunk talking to another. right? And when I got into, when I came into AA in 1987, you know, all I did was compare myself. I'm a street guy, you know. If there was a woman at the podium, I didn't, you know, like immediately, you know, just not like me. If there was someone of a different race, not like me, different color, not like me, different religion, not like me, you know. I'm just a, you know, old white guy, you know, that's who I can listen to, right? And it wasn't until one day when my sponsor said to me, Jimmy, in order to understand the story, or more importantly, identify with the story, you got to ask yourself three questions. Do I think like that? Do I feel like that? Do I drink like that? And when that became a part of my DNA, I was able to hear anyone that was standing at a podium. I was able to read the stories in the back of the big book and identify with that stuff, even though they came from all different times and places. You know, I could pick up a grapevine, you know, and read the stories in a grapevine, and I could identify because I'm able to understand how I feel, how I think, and how I drink, you know. So the AA story has always been, you know, there's a million and one stories out there, right? We all have a story in here. My story might not help. My story's not supposed to help everyone, right? Some of you guys might say, okay, I'm ready to go home now. But the fact of the matter is, we all have a story, right? And there was a guy by the name of Howard P., John, your sober uncle, just so you know, Howard Pullens from Gilbert, Arizona. And Howard was an interesting guy. My sponsor sponsored him. He was 57 years sober when he died. He was a scientist. He worked for the government. He was the guy that, he was part of the team that created the Apache helicopter. And he was a brilliant man. And if you saw him at a retreat, I mean, a conference or a retreat, boy, that guy would just take over, and, you know, he'd hold court for 5 hours in a hotel lobby room, just telling story after story after story, right? So he used to tell this story about a baby elephant, and I thought it was kind of ridiculous when I first heard it, but now as I hear it again, and as I've repeated the story, you know, numerous times, this story has a lot of power in it, because I think it affects every one of us in this room today. And I'll read it because I think it's better when I read it. But when he was a young boy growing up in Kansas, in the late 1930s, he watched a travelogue movie, a documentary on, about training elephants in India, you know, and they started the training of the baby elephants by tying a rope tightly to their right foot and the other end to a rope to a tree. In that way, the baby elephant is taught that when the rope is tight, it's futile to keep pulling against it. And throughout the elephant's career, the trainer reinforces this lesson. At the end of the movie, they show a huge elephant strong enough to drag a tree out of the forest being held by a rope tied to a stake that's driven into the ground. The big elephant was free to walk around in that area, but when the stake rope got tight on his leg, he stopped pulling. So what held that elephant? Was it the rope? Was it the stake? No. The moral of that story was what held that elephant was the baby belief system that was imposed upon him from the trainer as a young elephant. And I bring that up because coming into AA, I had thousands of baby elephant belief systems, right? And see, spirituality, recovery is about not addition, it's about subtraction. And I don't know about anybody else in this room. I had to unlearn a lot of old ideas to get free in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and I didn't even understand that until I was confronted with that. You know, one of my old ideas was what my relationship with my father was like. And I talked a little bit about that last night. You know, my old man was, you know, I looking back now, I think he was a hard drinker. He wasn't an alcoholic, you know, according to our definition of the drinkers in the big book, right? I mean, he seemed to drink every day. You would look at him and say, this guy's an alcoholic. But the doctors came to him at the age, I think, 57, 58 years old. He had type 1 diabetes. The doctor said, if you keep drinking, I'm gonna start cutting things off you. And my old man put the plug in a jug, and he never drank again. But he didn't change. He was angry. He was probably more angry than he was when he was drinking. And he was more violent when he was drinking. So, you know, so my father, he was just a tough guy to be around. And, you know, looking back, I did love my father. I just didn't understand my father. Or more importantly, I didn't understand, say, let's just call it the disease of alcoholism. Like, why would a guy treat his family the way he was treating us? Why would he hit his kids? Why would he throw stuff around the house? Why would he be like a tornado roaring through the lives of all of us? How do you deal with that as a young kid? I mean, some of us talked about that, the small group we had last night. You know, this not only physical, but this emotional beating up all the time. You're not good enough. You're not good enough. You're a piece of crap. All that stuff went on in my house to everyone. And so, you know, as life was going on, you know, I was getting a little bit older. You know, I remember playing I started to play football. I was 15 years old. I was trying out for high school football. I was starting to go in the weight room when I was a young kid. I was always in shape back when I was young. And I remember having an argument with my old man, and he went to throw a punch at me, and I grabbed his hand. I had the strength to hold his hand. And he never raised his hand against me because he knew he didn't have a prayer against me anymore. You know, he didn't have a prayer. And our relationship was really bad after that. My two brothers and my sister, who were older than me, the minute they graduated high school and went to college, they took off. And now I'm left at home, me, the wolf, and my little sister. And I just become the brunt of his anger. And looking back, he just didn't understand me. Like I said yesterday, man, I was starting to live this way of life, living on the streets, drinking, drugging, doing all the things I'm doing. I introduced my parents to a way of life they never even knew existed, you know? And he was baffled by me, you know? And so, you know, what happened was I got sober, you know, 18 months sober. Well, let me go backtrack a little bit. You know, I get sober and, you know, I'm starting to, I don't want to say I'm buddy-buddy with my old man. It was never like that. But what happened was I started to bring you home. I started to bring guys like John to my house. I started to bring guys like Tom to my house. Jared, James, you know. And I don't mean figuratively. Just, I would go to my house and my dad goes, how's that A&A thing doing? And I would say, yeah, I met this cool guy, John. He was telling me about this. And then, you know, Jared was telling me about that. And I would just tell stories that you guys told in a meeting. And I would bring that home. And little by slowly, the ice started to melt between me and my father. Mm. We would start to have conversation. I never had a conversation with my father. It was always screaming, yelling, or, you know, I just walked away from him. But we were able to sit in the same room, and we started able to talk a little bit about life, maybe, you know. So the ice started to melt. I remember when I had 90 days up in Jersey, we don't do the chip system like you guys do down here. The way you celebrate in New Jersey is that it's a 90-day pinning and then yearly celebrates, right? And we used to have this little gold triangle, if any of you guys remember. It was called the 90-day pin. And I'll never forget, I had 90 days, I'm in this meeting, my home group back then, like I said, was the smoke was from the top of the tables to the ceiling, you couldn't even see anyone, and my parents were sitting in the front row. I had 90 days sobriety. My father didn't believe I was sober, but he came, I couldn't believe he even came to this meeting. And he started to see a lot of the kids of his friends, and you know, he was shocked at who was at AA meeting, you know, and I couldn't even see who my parents were, but I know what their kneecaps looked like. That was how much smoke was in the room, you know? So little by little, my dad started to see you guys working in his son's life. And the ice started to melt. I'm 18 months sober. I'm back with that wife. My life is going pretty good, I guess. You know, I'm not drinking, going to meetings. I haven't gotten introduced to the steps yet, so I'm a little out of my mind, but I'm still sober, and I'm still going to your meetings, and I'm still part of the fellowship, and I'm still part of the home group, and I'm doing all the things we do in the home group, making coffee, setting up, breaking down, whatever, you name it, I'm doing it, you know, because I know the importance of them, because they told me herd mentality works here. And I'm 18 months sober. I used to go visit my parents. I worked on the highway authority for a bunch of years, And I came off a midnight shift that my dad used to read the Daily News, and I brought Daily News, the bagels, the coffee, I brought it to his house, and I walked in 18 months sober, and I found my father dead on the ground, 63 years old, heavy smoker, four packs a day, no filter, Camels, you know, those old school cigarettes, and he had a little heart procedure that cracked his sternum, he didn't have the strength, so basically he drowned in his own fluid. So I'm standing there over his father. Now, I come from a time in AA when 12-step calls, I talked about this last night, when 12-step calls were a common occurrence, three times. And when you live in a city, it's easy to do that. Three nights a week, my sponsor would call me up. He'd just say, 10 minutes downstairs. He didn't say, it's 11 o'clock, I got work tomorrow, or, you know, I'm having sex with my wife, 10 minutes downstairs. You were 10 minutes, you were downstairs. I was too afraid to say no to him. And I would go downstairs and, you know, he'd pick me up, he'd pick up another young guy, and there'd be another old-timer in the car, and we'd go to someone's house. And the way it worked was, you know, we walked into the house and the young guys, he'd say, Jimmy, go check if there's any weapons around, a gun or knives or anything of that nature. Let's get that out of the way. He'd tell the other guy, you know, go check on the wife and the kids to see if they're okay. And then we'd walk in the living room and we'd watch the magic. And what the magic was also two old timers would sit down and they would tell their story to that drunk, right? Identification. And then ask them that $64,000 question. You want help. And back then we didn't have a treatment center on every corner like we have down in here in Florida or in every other place. We didn't have really many detoxes. The hospitals were the only detoxes and you had to be really neat. You need them. So what we would do was put the guy in the car and we would drive to an AA meeting and we'd keep a pint of whiskey in a glove compartment. And the first time I saw that, I was like, we could do that? Like, you know, you can't do that, Jimmy, you know. But the point was, you know, why do we have to keep whiskey in a glove compartment? Well, in case that guy started to go into DTs or, you know, had to be walked off the ledge, you know, it wasn't like we had a pill of Librium or something like that to give him at the moment. And that was how we did it in 12-step work back then. Kind of a lost art these days. But I'm tuned to the sound of health. I am programmed to what it sounds like to be with a guy. So here I am standing over my old man's body and I call my sponsor. I said to him, you know, this is what's going on. He goes, all right, let's call 911 and let's pray. He's praying. I'm crying. And the first cop shows up and the cop's standing over my father. I swear to God, it was like, the cop's on like right this close. My dad's right here and I'm standing right here and I'm just looking down. Didn't even look like my father. He was so bloated with fluid that was built up in him. And the cop's asking me some questions. He's writing down a bunch of crap and he looks at me and goes, I don't see you walking the streets anymore. I said, yeah, I don't do that anymore. Taking a little bit more information down. He's looking at me. He goes, matter of fact, I don't see you drinking on the corner or drinking in any bars around here anymore. I said, yeah, I don't do that either. He goes, how do you do that? I said, well, I'll go to this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm 18 months sober, and apparently it's working right now. Then all of a sudden, this cop starts to talk about his drinking to me. I could hear it. I could hear what he's saying to me. He's telling me about his unmanageability. He's telling me about how he's jammed up on the job. He's telling me about once he starts, he can't stop because it is a phenomenon called craving, but he doesn't know it's the phenomenon called craving. He's talking about times when he doesn't want to drink, but he's drinking. Right? And he's going on and on and on. Now, he was a city cop, but he lived outside the city. And so I started to tell him my story. And I told him at the end of the story, you know, in your town, there's these guys I know because I've been to meetings in your towns. If you go to a meeting, you meet them, they're going to help you. And that was it. About 2 years ago, I'm in my home group down on the Jersey Shore. Big home group, 300 people, you know. The girls are over there reading the book. Guys are reading over there reading the book. Real pocket of enthusiasm. I'm up front line of my sponsees about something. And I get a tap on my shoulder. And I turn around. The guy goes, you know who I am? I said, no, I have no idea. He goes, I've been looking for you. I said, really? He goes, yeah, I heard you moved out of Jersey City. And that's the town I lived in. And I moved and I just couldn't find you for a long time. And then somebody mentioned your name and I remembered you and I found out that you lived down here and I came down to see, I said, well, who are you? He goes, I'm the police officer that was with you on the day that your dad died. And that next morning I went to that meeting and you told me and I met those guys that you were talking about and they took me under their wing. And I'm here to let you know that I just celebrated 34 years of sobriety. Now I don't have the power to get anyone drunk and I don't have the power to get anyone sober. Let me tell you something. God will use you without your permission. You see, the old timers used to say a phrase. It was, I need a drunk not to drink. I don't know if I was going to drink that day, but God knew I needed a drunk in my hands, right? The first spiritual truth was revealed to me. In order to get out of the darkness of your life, I have to serve others. That's what AA is all about, is serving others. And so this whole deal with my dad, you know, you know, when he died, I just had so many old ideas and so many resentments still and so many. And I went through the process of the steps. I wrote inventory of my old man. And, you know, my old man was a guy that, you remember 8mm films? You older guys might know that, right? My dad had drawers filled with them, right? And they were like alphabetical order, dates, all that stuff. It was kind of, you know, OCD back then, you know. And my niece calls me up and she goes, you know, all those 8mm? I said, yeah, my mom has them. Your aunt. And she goes, you think I can get them? I said, what for? She goes, I like to digitize them and put them together. I said, okay, fine. Call her up. And she did. And so like a year later, we're at a Thanksgiving a dinner at my cousin's house in North Jersey. And my niece announces to everyone, I got this DVD that I made, and I like to show it to everyone. She pops it in, and it's the story of my father. I had it all wrong. I couldn't see it. I couldn't see the vacations. I couldn't see the ball games. I couldn't see being taken to my first Yankee game. I couldn't see my first Giant game. I couldn't see the camping trips. I couldn't see the Boy Scouts. I couldn't see all the things my dad did for us and his kids and the colleges he paid for on a butcher's salary. How do you pay for five major universities on a butcher's salary? I don't know how the hell he ever pulled that off. And his whole life was on this DVD, and I had it all wrong about him. And I started to cry. I think my family thought I was drinking again. I'm watching this thing and I'm crying because I was so moved by what was going on. I just couldn't stop crying. It changed everything. You see, forgiveness is a tough pill to swallow sometimes because the ego wants to hold on to that stuff. The ego wants someone to blame. You see, what I found out about holding on to resentment, holding on to a grievance, just being plain old pissed off, three things are going on. First thing is I take everything personal. I made it all about me. I made everything about him with him. Never considered what he was going through. And so my mother sat down with me, and she started to tell me about my dad, which I never even knew. She pulled out a picture one day, and I'm standing there, and she goes, you know who this is? I said, nope, but it looks like me. She goes, that's your grandfather. That was your dad's dad. He was a cattle rancher in Budapest, Hungary. And if you looked at this picture, guys, I'm telling you, you would have thought it was me, like a great adventure, putting on a rancher's outfit. This guy had a handlebar mustache, but it shot the hell out of me when I saw this picture. It looked like I was looking in the mirror. She told me the story of my grandfather. He was a drunk, and he died at 38 years old from drinking in a field in Budapest, Hungary. And when my dad and his family came to the United States, my dad was 16 years old, and he became the man of the family for his brother and his sister. And really what happened to him, and this is a common story I hear a lot of times, he didn't even have a chance to be a child or even a teenager. He had to go work. He had to go provide. He eventually went into the Navy. I mean, you know, his life was taken away. And I never even knew that. I knew none of that. And when he got out of the Navy, he met my mom. They got married, and he became a butcher. We ate good growing up, but I never knew that. I never knew that. About a year and a half later, 2 years later, I'm with my mother. Well, but even prior to that, me and my mother used to go to all the grave sites at Christmas time. You know, we buy those overpriced, you know, grave blankets, bring them to my father's grave, bring them to my grandparents' grave, put them down. I'm the only one out of all my brothers and sisters who know where my dad and my mom, well, now my mom are buried. So we used to do that every Christmas. My mom would ask me to do that. So we stopped doing it for a little while. And I'm in a meditation one day, and this meditation keeps on pulling me, keeps on saying to me, I hear this in this meditation, go to the grave, go to the grave, go to the grave. And I'm like, I'm trying to deny that feeling. And I wake up, I come out of the meditation, I walk into the living room, I'm talking to my wife, I said, you know, I had this strange meditation, I'm being pulled, something's going on inside of me to go to the grave site. And so, now my mom's dead, right? And when I used to take my mom to the gravesite, you know, it was a routine, right? We'd buy the blankets, we'd buy the wreaths, we'd drive up North Jersey, go to the gravesite, you know, say a little prayer, put everything down, clean out the leaves, you know, that kind of stuff. And then we'd get it in the car, and right when you drove out of the the cemetery, there was a little strip mall, and then there was a Dunkin' Donuts. And like clockwork, my mother would say, go to the Dunkin' Donuts, I gotta go to the bathroom, and I wanna get a cup of coffee and a jelly donut. That was my mom's deal. 2 years later, tell my wife about this. She goes, you gotta pay attention to that. Something's telling you to get to that gravesite. So I do the same routine. I get in my truck. I buy all the overpriced stuff. I drive up to North Jersey. I go in the graveyard. I find the gravesite. And now I see my mom's name on the headstone of my father. And it hits me. My parents are dead. I don't want to say I'm an orphan, but I'm an orphan, you know? And it just hits me. It just hits me, like, in a way that I've never felt before. And I start bawling my eyes out in the middle of the cemetery. And I don't even know why I'm crying. I'm just uncontrollably crying. And I get in my car, and I'm going home. But my truck has, like, its own mind of itself, and it pulls into the strip mall. I don't want to go in the strip mall. I want to get home. And all of a sudden, I'm walking into Dunkin' Donuts. I don't want to walk into Dunkin' Donuts, but I'm walking into Dunkin' Donuts. All of a sudden, I'm ordering a small coffee like my mother used to get, and I get a jelly donut like my mother always gets. And I don't even like jelly donuts. It is so bizarre. It's almost an out-of-body experience. And I get back in my truck, and I just put my head on the steering wheel, and I can't stop crying. I had it all wrong. And this lack of empathy, this lack of forgiveness, this lack, this ideal that I put my parents on, some stupid ideal that they were supposed to be a certain way. It was shattered that day. It was shattered that day. And it was liberating to let go and let God. My sponsor would say that all the time. You got to let go and let God. You got to pray for people. Like, how the hell do you do that? Like, that one of those problems I brought up last night, one of those things, you know. How do I live this spiritual life? Oh, let go and let God. How do you do that? And sometimes it's just the realization that I'm powerless over a lot of things. And sometimes it's just the fact that, you know what, I gotta, like, see the truth. And that's the importance of inventory. That's the importance of getting this stuff out of here and getting it on paper and sharing it with another man. And I was free. And now, you know, I always thought this topic, or I always thought, you know, talking about my old man was about beating him up. I had it all wrong. I had to start looking at some of the attributes my father gave me. If I'm claiming to be a sober man, if I'm claiming to be a guy that's on this path, if I'm claiming to be a spiritual being and I'm trying to carry the message of God to others, then how am I really acting? So I had to start looking at some of the attributes my father gave me. Organizational skills, taught me a lot about tools, taught me about a lot about building. Things I took for granted, never really took advantage of this stuff. But he gave me a lot of attributes. And more importantly, I got a 33-year-old son. And I'll tell this story later on, but I walked out of my family when my kids were 8 and 5 years old, sober. I blew up my life 10 years sober for another woman. I'll talk about that later. How do you make amends to a 5-year-old boy that's looking at you when you say to him, "You're leaving?" And I'm like, "Yeah." And I was so, the level of selfishness inside of me, I couldn't even look this kid in the eyes. And I walked out that house never to go back. How do you make amends to that? And I had to build a relationship with my son, and thank God I did. And I'll talk a lot about that later on, but I had to build this relationship. So I look at my son today, 33 years old. Project manager for a huge financial company out of London, England. Married, house, 33 years old. I couldn't put two nickels together. This kid's on his way to stardom, I like to say. He was a big college football player. He's got a life that is unbelievable. And when I look at that, I look at our relationship and what kind of dad was I through the years. And I think really that's the question I'm trying to bring up here is, who will we become? Or are we still hanging our hat on, it's his fault? Because walking around with resentment, walking around with a grievance, being pissed off at my old man, being pissed off at your mom, being pissed off at anyone, what's going on? I'm taking everything personal. Or I'm blaming him for everything that's going on in my life. Or even worse, and probably the worst thing, I'm trying to control the situation. And that's one of the biggest delusions, that we have power of control. This book right here, I read this book. So I said, you know, I like to read a lot of books. This book is called Recovery, right? 12 Steps as a Spiritual Practice. This is written by a rabbi. Now, I'm not Jewish, but that has nothing to do with it. His name is Rami Shapiro. And he kind of gives his version of the 12 steps through here, right? And he's a member of Overeaters Anonymous, right? And my sponsor said, why don't you read that book? It's a good book. So I read this book. This is how this book opens up. Here's the heart of 12-step recovery. Quit playing God. 12-step recovery is about freeing yourself from playing God. What does it mean to play God? It means living under the delusion that life is controllable. It means constantly struggling to maintain the illusion that you are controlling it. It means lying to yourself all day, every day, insisting that with enough effort, you can get life to do whatever you want it to do. It means having to mask your failure at controlling life by blaming others. Your parents, your spouse, your children, your partner, your colleagues, your friends, for your failure. It means having to dull the pain of failure with booze, with pills, with television, with overwork, or whatever your method of numbing yourself to the reality of life's uncontrollability. It means spiraling into the madness of delusional thoughts and addictive behaviors that make sense only to a mind drunk on the insanity of its own divinity. I am God. The walls have to come down. And as I ended that little story last night about walking into the darkness of my life, I had to start bringing down those walls of alibis, excuses, and blame, and taking things personal, and having to come to the realization that I can't control crap, that I can't get you to do anything I want you to do. And I had to wake up to that. Because you see, spiritual warriors walk towards their pain. They don't avoid their pain. And the only pain we have in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous is when we resist change. And for many years, I sat in the rooms resisting change. And as a result of that, I suffered. Like to call it untreated alcoholism? You can. Right? But I suffered because I resisted change. I wasn't willing to go to any length that you guys were going to get free. And I was hanging my hat on my times. You know, 5 years, 10 years, you know, 10 years, I blow my life up in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, after I did that fifth step, it was the most powerful day. That original fifth step was the most powerful day of my life, other than my two children being born. You know, then I fell for the biggest trap we have in Alcoholics Anonymous. I fell prey to comfortability. All of a sudden, overtime was more important. Coaching baseball was important. Coaching girls basketball was important. Nothing wrong with that stuff, but that overcame my primary purpose. And all of a sudden, all those external things became my real goal. And little by little, I saw the drift in AA, and I didn't even see the drift. We're the last to always see the drift. I always explain, like, I had a boat, and I take it out in the ocean. I live on the ocean in the Jersey Shore. I take the boat out, you know, I'm facing east, and I can see the most spectacular, like you guys, I can see the most spectacular thing every day of the week. That's called the sunrise. And I could sit out on that water and I could see the curvature of the earth. I could see that sun come up. But what I don't see is what a lot of us don't see is the drift. I'm going town to town to town. 5 years, 6 years, 8 years, 9 years, 10 years. Me and my wife back to fighting, getting financial trouble, living in fear, living in resentment, living in anger. I walk into a meeting one day and I know this girl and she knows me and I know her husband. She shows me a little of attention and all of a sudden hook, line, and sinker. I have a relationship with this woman. I walk out of my marriage, the guy with morals, the guy with values. All of a sudden, I toss that to the side for a piece of you know what, and I jump into a romance and I blow up my life in Alcoholics Anonymous at 10 years without a drink. I'm the guy that builds a beautiful spiritual structure for me and my family, and I tear it down with a senseless series of sprees. And let me tell you something, you don't need to be drinking to blow up your life in Alcoholics Anonymous. Just sponsor people. You'll find that out. July 8th, 1997, my daughter's birthday. July 9th, 1997, my son's birthday. July 10th, 1997, the sheriffs are taking me out of my house because of my anger. Stone cold sober. And as my wife is standing there with those two little 8-year-old and 5-year-old looking at me, where are you going, Daddy? I got to leave. And I walked out of those kids' life. The level of selfishness and self-centeredness. I didn't even think I was capable of that until I was there. And I blow up my life in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd like to tell you it all ended nice, but it didn't. Within 3 years, I had so much rage and anger. I was telling my sponsor about was about 20% of what was going on. I'm being dishonest. It's like I never went through the steps. That's how fast I turned and went back to that old way of living. Sober. Talk about painful. Sober. Well, not drinking, let me put it that way. I had 13 years without a drink. I'm done. I'm fed up. I hate my life. I hate you. I hate everything. And I walk in a bar. This is it. I'm going to drink. I understand what Dr. Bob's talking about when he says he was stuck between a rock and a hard place. I don't want a drink. Man, I need a drink. And I walk in a bar and I say, bartender, give me a drink. It's right there. Devil and the angel pop out. Drink it. Don't drink it. Drink it. It felt like I was in a blackout, like just staring at this glass of booze. When all of a sudden a hand goes around the glass and pulls it back. And when I look up, the bartender just happened to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. What are you doing? Apparently throwing my life away. I took my tail and I put it between my legs and I walked out the door. Watched the human ego. 2 weeks later, I'm in a meeting that I've never been to. And this guy, a guy from your neighborhood, a lot of you guys know him, Peter M., was doing a workshop down in my town. And 2 weeks early, I wanted a drink and, you know, end it all. And 2 weeks later, I'm in a meeting and I'm judging this guy. Hey, Tanner Mayer, this shit. But by the end of the meeting, I had him in the headlock saying, you will sponsor me. And for the next 17 years, he did sponsor me. We're very close, you know. We both now have the same sponsor. But it's just funny how that all happened. But what had to happen to me was I had to hit bottom. Right? I had to hit bottom. I had to start looking at this thing with a new pair of glasses. One of the things he said to me once, it was after I came out of a fit step with him, and I hope to talk about this other thing he had me do, this whole exercise that's not in the book. It's about, you know, really examine your ideas, your old ideas, your emotions, your attitudes, right? A lot of us are walking around with a lot of old ideas that we don't even know we have. Why? Because they're under the surface, they're root of our troubles. We don't even see them. Shit that's been in my head for 30 years because my old man put it in my head, or my mom put it in my head, or teachers put it in my head, and I think it's fact. Something like real men are strong. Really? Where'd that come from? Real men don't carry debt. Where'd that come from? Real men make money. Where'd that come from? All right, I take it as fact. It's like a cloud going by. I grab the cloud, put it in my head. It's reality. I think that's the way it's supposed to be. So I go through the work with him and, you know, we're going into the steps 6 and 7 and was talking about a lot of different things about being willing to hand God. What am I willing to stop doing? What am I willing to start doing? Where's this change going to start to occur? When am I really going to put my hand in God's hand and start living this way of life? And he says to me, Jimmy, I want you to give you a consideration, not a question, a consideration. Think about it. Bring it into prayer. Bring it to meditation. Reflect on it. He says, do you look at the people in your life, the situations of your life, or the circumstances of your life through the lens of a character defect or through the eyes of God? Do you look at your wife, your father, your parents, your brothers, AA members, workers, neighbors, whatever? Do you look at them with anger, fear, envy, jealousy, resentment, you know, selfishness? I mean, you can list the character defects, right? You look at the situations in your life. Now, I'll talk about this. 1999, December 6, 1999, I got retired. I was in a horrific accident on the New Jersey Turnpike where I worked. Worked on the Highway Authority. I've had 41 surgeries in the last 20 years. I've had 12 back operations, 3 knee replacements. My neck collapsed. I had to get 3 artificial discs in my neck. I'm really 5'8", but with all the metal in me, I'm 6'4". It's a miracle. But I've been through the ringer physically. Physically, I've been through the ringer, and I got retired on that day at the age of 40 years old. Right? Got my pension, got all that stuff, took him to court, won some money, blah, 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 blah. The circumstances of my life. Am I still living with guilt and shame of the crimes I caused when I was younger? Have I really made that right? Have I really gone through the amends process and cleaned up my life? Or am I just pushing that to the side, saying that's not important? Or have I had this transformation where I could start looking at people in my life with forgiveness, like my old man, with compassion, with like my mother, with love? If love and tolerance is our code, I got to ask you a question. Is it really? What's it look like at the diner after the West Side Men's Group? Are we in there judging every guy that walks in that meeting or the speaker that night because we don't like the message he brought? Or maybe you're doing that to me right now. Right? Where's the transformation happening in your life? Now, again, granted, none of us do this stuff perfectly. We know that, right? my sponsor's famous for saying we're all human beings on a spiritual walk, but we're going to lose focus of the walk sometimes, and our humanness is going to get the best of us. And as a result of that, we're going to make mistakes, yeah. See, the pathway to God is filled with potholes and landmines. And it's not a straight line. If I tell you I'm going to the straight to the top of the mountain, I can guarantee you this, it's like this. It's trails. It's a lot of movement. And like I said last night, I didn't get on a spiritual rocket ship and go up, up, and away. Recovery's about hitting walls and hitting walls and hitting walls and hitting bottoms in sobriety, second surrender, third surrender, 10th surrender, 100th surrender. But the point of the surrender is I have to turn back to God. I have to turn back to these 12 steps. I have to turn back to the men of my life, the fellowship of my life. You know, this three equilateral triangle that we have of unity, recovery, and service. I got to get in the middle of that. I got to get into the herd, right? That 90-day pin had a dot in the middle. My sponsor, anyone would go to a podium with your sponsor, this is the first thing your sponsor would say. See that little insignificant dot? Yeah, that's you. You're not that important. But I'm going to make you a promise. You put one hand in God, you put one hand in AA, you'll never have a drink again. They didn't lie to me. That being said, I make a lot of mistakes. And so this whole deal with my old man, you know, it was freeing. I got free because I could have came in here for the next 20 years complaining about that guy. I could have complained about everyone in my life. It doesn't. I'm just using him as an example. It could be your mother. It could be a wife. It could be anything. What am I relate? Have my relationships healed as a result of God and the 12 steps? Or am I still holding on to something that I'm not willing to let go? And if you're not, acknowledge it. If you're not, talk about it. If you're not, sit down with your sponsor. If you're not, maybe write some inventory on it. If you're not, just maybe, pull that spiritual mirror that we all have in our back pocket and look in that mirror and say, how is this serving me? Is it really blocking me from God? And if it's blocking me from God, guess what? It's blocking me from you. You know, so we were talking before, you know, me and Tony, you know, how easy it is to walk into a room and, hey, Tony, how you doing? Everything's great. Everything is great. As the veins are about to pop out of my neck. Everything's great. How you doing? How you doing? It's a Jersey thing. How you doing? Right? Let me take the focus off me and let me put it on your lap. And as a result of that, I stay sick. That's all I have, guys.